from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Parents know, maybe you know, that having children can be one of life's most beautiful experiences. But raising the next generation of Americans is also costly and difficult. Our guest tonight says American parents deserve more help than they're getting. Tonight on Point, the Parenthood Subsidy, a controversial blueprint for helping out the parents who are raising America's future. But first, the Supreme Court today took up the long-running fight over public access to records of Vice President Dick Cheney. The Sierra Club and Judicial Watch have sued the vice president in an attempt to force him to release the names of the people he consulted in putting together the Bush administration's energy policy. Vivica Novak covers the Supreme Court for Time magazine and was in the court today. I asked her how the justices responded to today's arguments.
The court had quite a few questions for both sides, and on the whole, it seemed as though some of the justices were saying that Ted Olson, the Solicitor General who was arguing for the government, was kind of asking for too much, basically saying that the justices have no say really over what the executive asserts is true. It's reminiscent of other arguments this administration has made. It's an administration that believes very strongly in a sort of muscular executive branch, a muscular White House. And you've heard it with the detainees at Guantanamo. You'll hear it tomorrow with the Padilla and Hamdi cases, the two U.S. citizens who have been held in this country without access to lawyers or other due process. And in various other ways, you've heard this administration say that really other branches of government should not be asking questions about how it operates in time of war or otherwise. And on the other side, I think there were also some skeptics saying that the Sierra Club and Judicial Watch should be able to get as much as they want to get, as much information as they want. But it's all sort of procedural at this point. I mean, this case has been going on for 3 years now, and still there has been no real progress in terms of getting the information.
So the administration making a separation of powers argument. Vivica, remind us of the basic details of this case and how it made its way to the Supreme Court.
As you recall, Vice President Cheney headed up a task force to come up with an energy plan for the nation in early 2001, which they did, he did. And the question really is, other than administration officials, and there were something like six other cabinet secretaries and other agency officials involved, but aside from them, who helped to formulate this policy? Who got to participate? And the environmental groups know that they didn't get to participate, but there are many stories of meetings that the administration had, the task force had, with energy lobbyists and energy company executives.
Including Ken Lay of Enron, as I understand.
Yes, including Enron. And so some people want to find out exactly who the administration was meeting with and what those meetings were about. So they have asked for lists of participants in meetings and minutes of the meetings. There have been several suits along these lines filed, and some of the information has come from FOIA requests filed to other agencies, some of the agencies that also took part in the task force. But the vice president's office has always declined to release information like this.
Though a federal judge has ordered what Ted Olson called a broad unconstitutional release of White House documents, and that has put it in the lap of the Supreme Court, the White House refusing that order or contesting that order.
With several other procedural steps along the way that are essentially boring, but basically have delayed things and have thrown things into the lap of the Supreme Court.
Vivica Novak, is there precedent for a White House being asked for the release of this kind of information about the details of who did what in making White House policy?
Well, yes. The Hillary Rodham Clinton health care task force was similar in this way.
You mean Hillary Clinton's involvement in the big Clinton health care reform that was ultimately rejected?
That's right. And that, actually, that example was cited a few times in the argument today. And that's the only other one I can really think of. There were some differences in that case. But this is a new day with this administration, and although the previous administration may have fought it, this administration has kind of a policy, a blanket policy of not releasing information that this seems to be part and parcel of.
Did any justice on the court today speak to the administration's record of or reputation for very tight secrecy?
Not really. I mean, not to any great degree. The justice that everyone was paying the most attention to, of course, was Justice Scalia, whose controversy, I guess, has almost overshadowed the case.
That is, his hunting trip with Dick Cheney in Louisiana.
That's right, and he did not recuse himself. And actually, as I was standing outside the Supreme Court this morning waiting to go in, around the side where the press goes, a fellow from the front, somebody from the who was lining up to be in the audience, I guess, ran around the side and started yelling at the top of his lungs, "Scalia, recuse! Scalia, recuse!" and yelling up at the building. So there was some heckling going on, but Scalia participated as actively as ever.
What kind of calendar will the court's deliberation be on? Might they come out with a decision that would fall right in the middle of the heat of the campaign as we head toward November?
Well, sure. The decision will have to be issued by the end of June when the court goes out of session. And so it's possible, as it works its way back through the lower courts and things actually have to start happening, if the court decides against the administration, that documents will start to be released this summer, which could be embarrassing for the White House. Of course, we don't know what's in them. We don't know how embarrassing they are, but it's certainly possible that it could be an issue.
And is this a case in which it's possible to decode how justices are likely to vote?
You know, that's always dangerous to do. I've tried to do that before by just judging the types of questions the justices are asking, and it's not a great predictor. But if there's some way they can cut some middle ground here, that seems the most likely. Courts, the Supreme Court especially, tends not to rule any more broadly than it has to, so it's going to probably cut the narrowest path it needs to settle this particular case without setting out any broad precepts. But it's really hard to tell which way it's going to go.
Well, a lot of eyes in the Republican camp and the Democrat will be watching very closely. Vivica Novak, thanks for joining us.
It's good to be with you.
Vivica Novak is Supreme Court correspondent for Time magazine. She spoke with us from Washington. Our guest tonight is a law professor at Yale University. She is also a mother to four-year-old twins. She's experiencing firsthand her part in the joys of parenthood. First steps, finger paintings on the fridge, Little League dance recitals. But she also knows the difficulties of parenting in America today, the costs, the time crunch in two-income households, the difficulty of doing it right. Stripped back social support makes child-rearing even harder, she says, and that, she says, is not fair. American parents need help to lighten the load, and the kind of help she proposes, $5,000 per year per child. This hour on Point, subsidizing parenthood and what society owes American parents. Are the economic and social challenges of parenthood today a burden, an unreasonable burden? Would $5,000 per year per child ease the load? Is cash the problem? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New Haven, Connecticut, is Ann Alstott, professor of law at Yale University and author of What We Owe to Parents in the current issue of Boston Review magazine. Her forthcoming book on the subject is No Exit, What Parents Owe Their Children and What Society Owes Parents. Good evening and welcome, Ann Alstott.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks a lot for being with us. So, Ann, give us your argument. Everybody knows parenthood can be marvelous and it can be rough. You're saying it's so much more difficult now than it was at some other time that American parents need a cash subsidy to pull it off?
Yeah, that's the argument in a nutshell. You know, we often talk, as you did in your intro, about the difficulty of balancing work and family life. And my book and my inquiry are really about why that's so difficult. What's really behind that? And the basic point that I try and make is that, you know, a lot of the time we experience this as an internal conflict. Why is it so hard for me, you know, to do this or for you to do that? In fact, the dilemma arises because parenthood is a unique public role as well as a private role that, you know, a very intimate and emotional role. And I do think that society's expectations on parents have grown over the last few generations. At one time, and now we're talking about, you know, several generations back, but certainly at one time, when you had children, you were getting a financial investment as well as an emotional bonus.
Meaning what, a financial investment?
Well, meaning that at one time, children would be not only people that you would love for your entire life, but also workers on your farm, or they would join you in the factory. They would provide security for you in your old age. And, of course, it's quite wonderful that we no longer expect children to engage in child labor in this country. country. It's quite wonderful that we have Social Security. But at the same time, it means that there's been a very quiet shift in kind of the benefits and burdens of parenthood. At the same time that I think in modern society, our expectations for what children deserve have grown. So we expect parents to not only to put in 18 years, but to engage in a certain kind of intensive child rearing. College, some kind of college, has become the aspiration for almost everybody, as well as the kind of supervision that you have to give kids today. So, again, all of this is quite wonderful for children. I'm not in any way against progress in this way. I think we're recognizing the dignity and the needs of kids. But it is hard on parents, and there has been a substantial shift in what parents have to do.
And I've got to say, this is where you surprised me. When I first heard what you were writing about, I thought that you were going to say, to have a competitive next generation of Americans who are well-educated and well-raised, we need more help for parents to get it done, that it was about the children's welfare. Yes. But as I read what you're saying here, you're really saying it's about fairness for parents themselves. When you talk about no exit, you're saying, well, once you become a parent, there's no way out, and the costs are enormous, and the payoff isn't what it was when the kids were helping work the farm. It's really a fairness issue?
It is a fairness issue, and Tom, I think it's a fairness issue mostly because the great, great majority of parents are doing what they need to do. Somehow, most parents most of the time get it done, which is to say most parents have their priorities in the right places. We do hear horror stories, but by and large, most parents will make the self-sacrifice that they need to make for children to develop in the way that they need to. Not every parent is perfect, but by and large, parents do make that no-exit commitment, and I think most of us really understand, you know, when you're a parent, you get that no-exit moment. This child is here. It's a real human being, and I must not leave. And most parents do that. So my argument is not about how to get parents to do that, although, you know, we certainly could have that conversation, too, about the relatively small group of parents who don't get it or aren't able to do what they need to do. But most parents do, and, you know, at all income levels and all kinds of situations, they get it, and they do it right at considerable cost to themselves. So my argument really is a fairness argument,
because
it's the parents who are doing it right, Tom, that pay the most, that are hit the hardest. Their own lives take the hardest hit.
But isn't this, I mean, you're saying in effect almost that parents should be paid to raise their own children. Why? Isn't that what having kids is all? You have kids, you raise them. Why should the state pay parents to raise their own kids?
Right. Well, you know, I think there's an important difference here. I'm arguing that we should help parents sort of balance the demands of child rearing and salvaging something for their own economic future. But I think there's a big difference between that and paying parents or treating parents as employees. You know, I do think it really...
Well, $5,000 per year per child for up to age 13. Well, it wouldn't be great pay, but if you've got several children, it would be a significant subsidy to many American incomes.
Well, it's not, I should say, just as a quibble, it's not $5,000 per child. It's per family. So, in other words, again, the focus is not on how many kids you have, but it's on whether you're a parent or not.
And okay,
so
got it.
If your household has kids, you get the $5,000. But, you know, certainly parents make a choice, and they have to live with that choice. There's no way we could make parents whole, even if we wanted to do that, and I don't. But there is a way in which, you know, my argument is that the benefits and burdens have gotten to be out of kilter. And I think the key is to understand that parenthood is not simply an activity like any other that we might choose to do and then flit from activity to activity. I think it's this no-exit quality that makes it really, really different. Society says, fine, choose to be a parent or not, but once you are in, for the good of that child, you should not leave.
But everybody knows that going in. There's no mystery about it. It's not like a surprise package here.
Exactly. There's no mystery about it. But the conversation we need to have is that fair? Is it fair? You know, we debate the content of our social roles all the time, don't we? You know, I was thinking today about the debate over marriage. You know, the debate over right now is who can get married. 30 years ago, there was a question about whether people could exit their marriages. And I suppose we could dismiss both debates by saying, well, you can choose to get married or not. But instead, we take seriously this question about what does it mean to be married? What should it be mean to be married? What are the benefits and burdens of marriage?
Well, you're making me think here, but I'm going to take some more persuading. I'm looking forward to it. Anne Allstott, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about what society owes the parents raising the next generation of Americans. Should American parents be compensated for the burdens of parenthood? We're at 1-800-423-2323. 8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about what society owes the parents raising the next generation of Americans. My guest is Anne Alstott. She's professor of law at Yale University, author of the forthcoming No Exit, What Parents Owe Their Children and What Society Owes Parents. You can join the conversation. Has delivering good parenthood just become too difficult in the U.S. culture and economy? Would $5,000 a year make it a little easier? Are overburdened parents failing to deliver the parenting Americans' children need? Would more money fix that? Are you offended by Anne Alstott's idea that parents should be paid for their trouble, or do you love the idea? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And I wish you'd lay out exactly what you're proposing in terms of this $5,000 cash transfer every year to parents. Is this just cash in an envelope? What can it be used for how long?
No, it isn't cash in an envelope, and I think that's a very important point. It isn't cash to be used for whatever one would like to do. The idea, and backed up by quite a lot of data, is that parents, and especially mothers today, are working less, earning less, and achieving less during their working years precisely because they're doing right by their children. Whether they're working full-time, they're working part-time, they're taking time out of the workforce, they're finding that they have a number of problems with their long-term economic opportunities. And so the $5,000 a year is aimed directly at that problem. What are the big blocks to economic opportunities for the average American family with kids? And so here's how it would work. Every household with kids would get $5,000 a year. It would be put into an account in their name. It wouldn't be cash in an envelope. And they could use this money for one of three purposes. They could use it to pay for child care while they work.
Okay.
So that's one way of improving your economic opportunities is to stay in the workforce. But, you know, many parents choose not to do that. That isn't consonant with their values. So there are other things you can do as well. The second thing you could do with your $5,000 is to put it toward your own, which is to say the parents' education. Parents, and especially mothers who take time out of the workforce or maybe they work part-time, find that to get back into that workforce, they may need to brush up on some skills, finish some education that they started at one time, and so you could use it for that. The third thing you could do is put it toward retirement savings because, again, women, mothers who are on average out of the workforce, they have interrupted job participation over their lifetime, they're going to end up lacking in retirement savings. So these are three big things.
Okay, so two out of three, and maybe more than that, are really focused on the parents' needs as much or more than the child's education for the parents, retirement for the parent, even child care so the parent can work, which really does present this as a way of bumping up the benefits of parenthood.
Bumping up the economic security of parenthood, I absolutely agree. And that is very much the focus of the program. We could talk about children's needs, but this is not a program about that, not because there aren't any, but because this was my particular program, my particular project.
So many questions. I guess, first of all, what would this cost? I mean, this has got to be incredibly expensive. What would it cost the country?
I think it's actually quite realistic. So if you run some numbers and you say that this amount of $5,000 would be paid to every household with kids until the child turns 13, it would cost net about $100 billion a year. Now, that's hardly small change, but nor is it awfully big in the era of the Bush administration's, you know, $1 trillion worth of tax cuts. So I believe it actually is feasible. It is realistic.
And $100 billion a year, it sounds like a lot of money. On the other hand, what about, I keep coming back to this argument that for parents, in some fundamental, profound level, children are their own reward.
Of course they are. And nothing in this proposal is at odds with that or demeans that, of course. You know, when I look at my kids, do I see little dollar signs or little burdens? Of course not. They're wonderful. I can't imagine a life without my kids. I think most of us can't imagine a life without our kids. But the satisfaction, again, I think it's tautological to say that kids must be their own satisfaction, and that's it. That's the choice that you made. It seems to me that when we understand understand that parents are raising the next generation, when we understand that the parents are on the front line of the educational system, the healthcare system, the emotional development system for these kids, we're demanding a lot of parents. And I think in recognition of their efforts, it's not too much to say, gee, let's pay attention to what happens to parents as parents. What is it that their lives look like? Why are their lives full of struggle? Why is it that quite a lot of these parents, and mothers especially, are going to enter old age with fairly precarious economic futures ahead of them? I don't think it any way demeans the parental role to recognize that it's a stressful one and a hard one.
There's no longer necessarily a farm to be harvested with all those kids, so let's pay parents for having them. And I'll stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Chicago, Richard Epstein. He's professor of law at the University of Chicago. Great. And thanks. We hear you there. Welcome, Richard Epstein.
Yes, glad to be here.
It's wonderful to have you. You have written one of the replies to Ann Alstadt's article in the Boston Review. You're quite critical of the idea. Give us your critique of what we owe to parents, the $5,000 annual subsidy.
Well, I think there are many of them. One obvious critique is to ask the very simple question, if you have a program that's this broad, whom is the money going to come from? And much of the money will have to come from parents. And so what happens is lots of this is simply going to be a transfer from one pocket to another rather than from one person to another.
So this it would go to all families, but it would essentially come out of the taxes of higher-income families, you're saying?
Secondly, it seems to me that there is no particular uniqueness about this particular obligation. One of the real problems that we got in with respect to Medicare and Medicaid is everybody starts talking about the social contract that we have with our parents. Mm-hmm. And how it was that they have done so much to raise us that in their old age we have to make sure that they get the right kind of medical care. And you end up with a program which may have started very modest, as Anne suggests this one would be, but in the end it is mushroomed to the point where the future potential liabilities of Social Security and Medicare threaten to overwhelm the entire federal budget.
Big budget problems. What about the fundamental argument that Ann Alstadt makes that the kind of a benefit and burden ratio of parenthood has shifted as the economy has shifted away from an agricultural economy, and that it's now all burden and not enough benefit, but yet society benefits from this next generation of kids coming
up. The argument is, in some sense, wildly overgeneralized. If the money is going to upper-middle-class parents, their ability to contract out their services, to have housekeepers, au pairs, and other people come in many ways their lives are much easier than they were before. With respect to low-income families, some of the burdens are very much greater, but a lot of that comes from taxes that are taken from their salary to pay redistributivist programs to other individuals. So in the end, if you don't means test this particular program, it may well be that the largest sums of money will go to those people with the greatest privilege. It's also not at all clear why 13 is a magic age. Most parents, if they're most worried about things, is trying to put aside money for college. And that, of course, suggests that you're worried about people between 18 and 21. In my case, I'm worried about graduate school and things like that with respect to my own children. So I think it's just a ceaseless situation, and what Anne has demonstrated is that there's always scarcity and that everybody would like to have more. But it turns out in this case, you're not going to be able to achieve it because the moment you try to condition it for three purposes, somebody's going to have to audit this money. So it's no longer going to be a question of just a $5,000 transfer. It's a $5,000 transfer.
And how's it being spent?
Well, is it being spent on child care?
Right,
is it really a disguised way to get somebody to mow your lawn?
Well, of course, it's fungible, too. If you spend it on child care, you can use that $5,000 for something else.
That's right. I think, in effect, it's completely fungible. But the worst of all possible worlds is a fungible way as a substitution with the government agencies that are going to have to audit. And I think, in effect, most parents would much prefer a slightly larger tax deduction from their thing just simply based on the number of kids you had, as we've used to do and perhaps still do today, I can't even remember anymore, rather than trying to receive audited accounts. I would be much more in favor of doing this through the tax system than the other way, with one caveat. When you do it through the tax system, huge numbers of poor people already pay no income tax, so you're out from underneath it. So in the end, when I put all the pluses and minuses together, I think that your basic point was most of us as parents know what we're getting into when we get into it. We try to save in advance in order to deal with it. We borrow a little bit against our future earnings, and by sort of borrowing and saving, we manage to cover the bump in the middle. And so I would basically stick pretty much with the status quo.
Well, it may be painful sometimes, but one way and another, it works. And I'll start, Richard Epstein, stand by. A lot of callers want to join the conversation. I want to invite them in. Ed is calling from Manchester, New Hampshire. Hi, Ed. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Great. Thanks.
Good. I got to be honest. Let me preface by saying, you know, I'm recently married.
Yeah.
And I plan on having children.
Okay.
And I don't mean to be a downer or anything, but I kind of find it offensive to think that there should be a $5,000 credit of whatever kind given out, because I think the talk should be more focused upon what a parent's doing to trim the excesses of their children rather than give me more money.
So you don't want
the parents are spending, where is it going? You know, is it just feeding them, or is it buying them Nintendo and this and that and indulging all their little, you know, fantasies of any kind?
So we hear you're not a parent yet, Ed. You don't know all the ways the money can flow, but you're saying don't subsidize my family. Thank you very much. I'll raise my children on my own.
Well, I think the money would be, if you told me the money was going to go into the educational system where all children would get an exceptional education, I could understand that. I could accept that. But I can't accept just, you know, having $5,000 handed out to people with children.
Yeah.
I just don't find that to be I just find it to be a very useful way to hand out the money. Give it to the educational system. If you're worried about the future, then let's educate these children exceptionally, and they'll get great jobs, they'll be responsible, and they will help with the future. But don't just hand somebody $5,000.
Ed, we've got it loud and clear, and it's a great point. And what about that? Why are you going at promoting money directly to families instead of addressing the kind of bigger issues Ed's raising? Why not put the money into fixing up the national education system?
Well, I think there's a deep connection between fixing the educational system and ensuring that parents are taken care of. You know, public education, you know, I'm with Ed. I think we should also fix public education.
But there's limited resources. You can't do everything. Why not put it into fundamental systems that are going to support the children?
I think parents are the main fundamental system that supports children. When parents fail, the educational system fails. And indeed, one of the reasons it's been so hard to actually save a lot of public schools and to make them function well is that when parents are under stress, their kids don't get what they need, the parents don't have what they need, and so the schools fail. You cannot have a hermetically sealed school system. You know, we take for granted what it is that parents do and the amount of stress that parents are under.
We could run this debate another way. I think the most important thing to do with respect to public education is to break the public school monopoly. You pay exorbitant sums for teachers who are heavily unionized. You block vouchers. You create all sorts of things. The way in which you will improve the system for parents is not to add another subsidy, but to get rid of a whole series of programs that probably don't belong and break up a lot of monopolies.
So there's a political view. And what about Ed's point? He's saying, you know, parents should simply look at what they're spending on their children, not be wasting a lot of money on Nintendo and cotton candy and such dreadful things.
Well, I don't think Ed's, Ed's a parent yet. But the average family, two important points. First of all, Ed, I think it is important. This is not cash in hand. And it's not cash in hand in some ways for precisely the reasons you're saying. You know, I was not particularly interested in supporting family consumption.
But it's almost equivalent. If you pick up my child care tab, I've got more money to spend.
Only if you were spending $5,000 a year on child care before, which most families, the majority of families, do not.
But, of course, many families spend close to that.
Separate purposes, and what happens is if you have a $50,000 average family income, it's hard to believe that most families don't spend at least $5,000 on one of those three goals.
Yes,
so I think, in effect, it becomes free cash.
No, I don't think so, Richard, because if you look at the data, a lot of families don't. You know,
$50,000.
Some don't. Many do. But the effect is likely to be to free up some cash, even if it's not the full $5,000.
It will free up some cash for some people.
Mm-hmm.
Those are I actually don't view that as a fundamental objection to the program.
You say, bring it on. Give mom and dad a vacation. Yeah, maybe they'll be better parents. I want to get another caller in here. Alex is calling from Chelmsford, Massachusetts. Hi, Alex. You're on the air.
How are you doing today?
Great, Alex. Thanks.
I have two questions. I can take them off the air.
Yeah.
Will this idea raise many of the issues that people have with welfare?
Mm-hmm.
And then two, will this promote a kind of, you know, I deserve attitude amongst parents where, you know, I think at least today parental apathy is one of the major issues in parenting?
Oh.
I think those are great questions. Can I take them, Tom?
Yeah, please, Ann.
I think it's really important to understand that this is a program about building economic opportunity, and it's not about welfare. So what's the difference?
Why isn't it welfare reduction?
One of the key objections that people have had in the last long time about welfare is that it discourages people from working, and this program doesn't discourage people from working. It actually makes it more possible for a lot of parents and a lot of mothers in particular. We have to keep an eye on the fact that this is not equally split between women and men, this burden of parental care. Child care cost is the single greatest barrier to mothers holding paid jobs. And so the whole thrust of welfare policy in the last generation has been to have low-income mothers work. And this program is very likely to support work. It's likely to support productive activity by people while also promoting choice about how they do that over time. So, Alex, I don't think it's welfare. As far as an I deserve mentality, I don't think so. Raising a kid, there are estimates about how much it costs to raise a kid, and conservatively it's about $200,000. And that's, I think, without all of the kind of Nintendo and cotton candy that Ed was worried about. That's just the basics of getting your kid raised. And so, you know, the idea that $5,000 a year is going to somehow turn us all into greedy and grasping folk, I think is exaggerated.
By the way, it's not $5,000 net. It's $5,000 net taxes, net administrative costs. The transfer program is likely to be largely dissipated. And in terms of the direction of the incentives, nobody really knows. There might be some people who say, with the extra $5,000, I could quit my job rather than to work in my job.
But Richard,
somebody will decide that instead of working in a highly paid, productive job, they'll be able to take a class and to do pottery.
Richard, that ignores what we know about women's labor supply.
Well, we know something, but the answer is we don't know anything about this particular program because we've never had this level of largesse, or at least this particular kind of transfer program, precisely because all everybody else has been so suspicious about the ways in which free cash will be handled that there are very few people who seem to be in favor of this. We had something like this with respect to the negative income tax when that was tried, and that was actually a conservative experiment that was abandoned because it didn't work.
This is the favorite strategy of the libertarian, which is to say that every kind of redistribution is welfare. The negative income tax is an income transfer. This is not an income transfer. I think the better analogy is the GI Bill. Right?
I mean, it has
a GI Bill for parents. And also, let me ask you something. I want to cut through that and just, you know, the bigger buzz in recent years has gone the other way. It's been kind of anti-parent, non-parents complaining that parents get too many breaks at the workplace and elsewhere. What about that?
Right. I think that's a very short-sighted view because it treats parents as if they're kind of obnoxious people who race, I don't know, loud vehicles of some kind up and down the streets and kind of purposely disrupt the lives of all of the rest of us. When in fact parents are doing incredibly important social work. So whether you want to put it in terms of raising the next generation of citizens who deserve good care, or whether you want to put it in terms of raising the next generation who will keep the economy going, this is not obnoxious behavior. This is absolutely fulfilling behavior, but it's also socially oriented behavior as well.
We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about what society owes the parents raising the next generation of Americans. Ann Alstadt is with us from Yale Law School, and Richard Epstein from the University of Chicago, professor of law there. You can join the conversation as well. Are you offended by Ann Alstadt's idea that parents should be paid for their trouble? Or do you love the idea? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We will be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about what society owes the parents raising the next generation of Americans. My guest tonight, Ann Alstadt, professor of law at Yale University, author of the forthcoming book, No Exit, What Parents Owe Their Children and What Society Owes Parents. And with us from Chicago, Richard Epstein, professor of law at the University of Chicago, author of Skepticism and Freedom, a Modern Case for Classical Liberalism. You can join this conversation as well. What does society owe the people who raise its next generation? Do you buy the fairness argument that it's only fair to help parents financially with the cost of child rearing? Should American parents be compensated for the burdens of parenthood? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Ingrid is calling from Belmont, Massachusetts. Hi, Ingrid. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I can't tell you how happy I am at her proposal. I personally think that a person should be paid $10,000 for each child a year. I am a mother, and I love everything that feminism has done, but they have left out one vital thing, and
okay.
that is to support motherhood and to financially support motherhood, because we live in a society where trade is reimbursed with money. And frankly, my job is a hard job. It's an incredibly hard job, and I do it well. And I'd frankly like to be reimbursed for it. And all of the suggestions she's making of where the money would go, they are all the things that are on this family's agenda: education, child care. It's precisely where it needs to go, but and I hope that it goes even further 20 years down the line.
Ingrid, let me ask you, though, what about the argument, and Anne Alstott has had it a lot, she addresses it right in her work, that children are their own reward, that when people have children, they're kind of signing up for a package deal, and the cost of raising children is the flip side of the joy of having children.
Well, children are amazing, but it's still a job. I put 3 square meals on the day. I have one child screaming because he's one and he doesn't understand what sharing is. I have the other child screaming because he fell down. It's an emotional, it's a sensual job.
But hasn't it always been so? And society has not always paid people to be parents.
No, it has always been that much of a job. And I think to respect the job, it should be treated as mm-hmm. a job, and it should be I should be paid to do it. And what is more important? Do you want good roads or do you want good citizens?
Well,
frankly, I would like good citizens.
I guess ultimately we've got to have both, but how to do it and do it in a way that's fair is the path. And also, you've got a big supporter here who says not just $5,000 but $10,000 per year per child, please, and HUP too, sooner the better.
Well, I think that's terrific, and I think, you know, Ingrid is talking about what her day-to-day life is like, and I think we can also think, and I'm sure Ingrid and her family think about, you know, what Ingrid is also not doing because she is with those kids, you know. She's a productive person. She could be out there doing something else. That family is giving up something, and whether, you know, mothers work full-time and somehow make it happen at home, whether they work part-time, whether they are out of the workforce, you know, and mothers, most mothers go in and out of those roles for 18 or 20 years.
But when you say the family is giving up something, I mean, isn't this from time immemorial?
No.
Part of the, well, of
no,
course, yes, we got your story that they bring the hay into the barn and all that.
But, I mean,
on the other, just a minute, please, Richard, one second, please. I just want to fully understand, Anne, if you aren't bringing some whole new concept here of fairness.
No, we you know, what is really interesting is I do think that we sometimes have an ahistorical view of parenthood. It's always been like this, and so why are we complaining now? And I don't think it has always been like this. You know, the modern conception of parenthood in terms of these children needing so much care, intensive care, and that parents should be devoted to them and have their priorities set according to these kids is an extremely recent view. So we talked a little bit about child labor before.
Mm, yeah.
But go back even a little bit further in Western history, and you'll find that, you know, until relatively recently, it was perfectly fine, even in Western culture, simply to abandon children you didn't want or couldn't provide for or didn't choose to provide for. That is anathema to us now. So that, you know, if you want to take the really, you know, a couple hundred years long perspective, you know, this no exit relationship between parent and child, this idea that we owe something to our children's psychological development is really a very new idea. And it's a very, very costly idea for parents, because when we say to you, don't exit, we're saying rearrange your priorities, your life, your job, your relationships to help this kid, give this kid what they need. That's a very modern conception of parenthood. And as Ingrid points out, I think it's not accidental that it's women doing this work. It's kind of become sub rosa. Women will do this work of, you know, this psychological work that has come into the package.
Got it. Richard Epstein, I hear you there on this point.
First of all, again, you know, there's a labor force participation of women now is higher than it's ever been, and lots of this is contracted out in some families, but not in all. And one of the things that one's worried about is that higher tax burdens generally will lead to a greater disintegration of a family. And the second thing you worry about is that Anne is so eagerly embracing Ingrid's proposal, and all of a sudden what's happened if you've got the average family with two? You're not talking about $100 billion a year. You're talking about $400 billion a year, and that's before you spend a single dime.
But what about Anne Alstott's argument that something fundamental has changed here?
I don't believe that. My parents cared as much about me as I think I've cared about my children. If anything,
the higher level
and standard of living means that we can do more for our parents than we did before. They had to work on the farm. Now they don't have to work on the farm. The single best thing that you could do for families is to increase overall levels of prosperity and to increase the level of discretionary income. And the moment we start doing it this particular way, we're going to have the same problem. You have parents who have packed to become disabled. You can't abandon them. The state now has to supply for that as well. The people you're going to tax will show you that they've got special obligations as well. You cannot focus simply on the hardships of one group, if they be hardships, and ignore the correlative hardships of everybody else. It's simply a question of special pleading by bringing to the fore one situation rather than others, and the basic instinct on these situations.
I want to get one more call in here. Michael is calling from Nashua, New Hampshire. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Great, Michael. Thanks.
My wife and I were sitting here and we're listening. We're young adults in our 30s.
Yeah.
We're professionals, and we see this as being a very reactive thing and not very proactive. We would love to have children. It's just not fiscally responsible for us to have them.
Because you don't have enough income yet, or is that what you're saying?
Yeah, we can't pay for college. We can't pay for clothes. I mean, basically, children are a decision, your personal decision. If you can't financially afford them, then you shouldn't have them. I mean, this $5,000 credit to us sounds like a middle-class welfare credit. I mean, explain it to me somewhere else. I mean, if you can't afford them, you shouldn't have them.
But are you then, Michael, essentially you and your wife are giving up on having children because the whole proposition looks too expensive?
Not necessarily that it looks too expensive, but that we know responsibly that we couldn't afford to provide children with all that they would need to have right now. Yeah, I guess we have to give up because we can't technically afford them. I think it's irresponsible to have children and not be able to bring them up in our modern-day society.
But that's a pretty big statement when two professionals feel they can't afford to have children. I'm not sure which way that observation argues here.
It's responsible.
I don't argue that. But on the other hand, if you have two income professional income earners and still, in your view, can't afford to have kids, that's quite a statement. Michael, our time is almost gone, but thank you so much for calling. And I'm going to give you the last word here. We've just got a half a minute left. You proposed $80,000 for 21-year-olds 5 years ago. That didn't happen. Any chance of this ever happening?
Indeed it will. In the United Kingdom, just this past year, they adopted a program that will give about $7,500 to every 18-year-old on their 18th birthday. And that was in part a direct result of the Stakeholder Society. Tony Blair got it. And the people of the UK got it. They now have their baby bonds, and wealth-building programs are the wave of the future.
And you see it the same thing one day happening for parents, a social recognition of a special obligation to parents.
Very much so.
Well, it may come, it may not. Richard Epstein, thanks for keeping our arguments sharp tonight. Thanks for joining us from Chicago. Richard Epstein, professor of law at the University of Chicago, and Anne Alstott, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Anne Alstott, professor of law at Yale University, author of the forthcoming book, No Exit, What Parents Owe Their Children and What Society Owes Parents. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, the confessions of a jewel thief. This is On Point. During his 30-year career as a jewel thief, Bill Mason stole more than $35 million worth in gems from the likes of Phyllis Diller, Armand Hammer, and Bob Hope. He was something out of a movie, scaling buildings and cracking safes and carrying out some of the most intricate jewel heists in history. Mason was eventually caught, though he ended up spending only a few years in prison. Now he's written about his three decades snagging jewels in his new book, Confessions of a Master Jewel Thief. In this radio diary, Bill Mason looks back on his infamous career, beginning with his successful break-in at the residence of tycoon Armand Hammer.
I couldn't figure out how to get in the building past the doorman. After a while, I figured a way that I could, using a grappling hook, pull myself up to about the third floor of a back stairway, which was located, and work my way between the security cameras up to her apartment, which I think was on the 16th floor or something like that, out of about 20. But the front door of the apartment had three very stable-looking locks on it and an alarm sticker. But I found that there was an apartment next door which was used as a guest suite. And after a while, I noticed that there was a very small ledge which ran around the entire perimeter of the apartment. So I figured if I could get into the guest apartment and I could work my way around on that ledge, I could work my way around to Armand Hammer's balcony. I chose a very rainy night, which I wanted to cover any noise I might make or cover anybody walking along on the street that had seen me dangling around on this ledge up there. It became very hairy as I was trying to edge my way along this thing. When I finally managed to edge my way over to the balcony, I found that, again, the balcony door was open and the jewelry was not in a safe but located in a jewelry box right in the dressing room. And I was in and out of there in probably 5 minutes, never using one of the tools that I was carrying with me or one of the tools that I had dragged up to the guest apartment. I think I liked the adrenaline rush. I became very addicted to the adrenaline rush after a while. The puzzle of putting all of these things together and trying to figure out how to circumvent all the security precautions and gave me a great thrill. I have lots of regrets. I regret what I did to my family. I regret what I did to a lot of these people. It was an invasion of their privacy. It was an invasion of many things. I think that I didn't look at them as objects. If I allowed myself to get too close to them so that I saw them as really people. I know one time I was casing out a couple who had a multitude of jewelry and were very flashy. And they came walking out of their high-rise building, which was my specialty, and started walking down the beach holding hands. And I thought, you know, this is a romantic, nice couple. And I just dropped the whole thing after months of planning. The last failed heist, if you want to call it that, was not really going. I had been released from prison after doing 5 years, and I'd done it for a year on parole, and on Marco Island, there was a member of the Collier family that lived in a penthouse apartment down there. I had no tools with me because I didn't want to carry anything with me. Being a well-known burglar, you can get charged with possession of burglary tools for almost anything. And I sort of got dumb and thought maybe I could lower a ladder, which I found up on the roof, down to their patio and be down, make it in there. Well, the ladder didn't quite reach the right distance, and when I started down and got all my weight on the ladder slipped off the edge and fell down about 22 stories down the side and left me hanging by my fingertips, and I'm looking over my shoulder watching this ladder bang down through the hitting the different patios and stuff, and I think it was a sign from God that I better rack up my grappling hook and go find something else to do, which I have done. That was a long time ago.
Bill Mason is author of Confessions of a Master Jewel Thief, the astonishing story of a high society cat burglar. He lives in New York City. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.